prepare yourself for the terror. The prison of madness, where few enter and none return.
Welcome to Unsung Horrors. With Lance. And Erica.
Leave all your sanity behind. It can't help you now.
Welcome to another episode of Unsung Horrors, the podcast where we discuss underseen horror films, specifically those which have fewer than 1,000 views on Letterboxd. I'm Erica.
I'm Lance.
However, it is No Rules November, and that means we are covering a film that has more than 1,000 views on Letterboxd, not an underseen. I mean, we're still talking underseen, but not the strict under 1,000 rule. We are going to be talking about The Man, Ray Dennis Steckler, this episode. So with us is our dear friend, Zach Carlson. Welcome back.
God bless.
Yay, Zach!
So for folks who don't know, Zach Carlson wrote the booklet for the, not even a booklet, it's a fucking book. It's 100 pages in the Severin Steckler box set.
It's a very attractive rectangle. The design on it and the art that they got
from it. Yeah, Earl Kess.
It came out really nice.
I mean, yeah.
Yeah, like it's of these sets that they're doing, these like comprehensive-ish filmmaker collections, like I feel like they're really like hitting some kind of stride with this stuff. Like, because they're taking stuff that most people are buying this, haven't even heard of these filmmakers, but they're just so...
Milligan and Indicator just put a few out for Charles Murphy, I think is the name. I think I got that wrong.
Wait, is it the guy that did the shot on video stuff in the 80s?
Yeah, the British one?
Yeah. Mike. It's
Michael Murphy. Yeah. Thank you. Yeah, they're giving a lot of love to these. And I text you when you won the Shelf Shock Awards. Like, this got the award for best booklet.
That just blew my mind.
Yeah.
I didn't know that anybody would read it.
Yeah. I read it. It's fantastic. It's informative. It's funny.
It made the editor cry. I don't say her name now because she'll kick my ass. But
you can read in the back of the book of the editor.
But yeah, I had to turn it in late because it was a really difficult research project. Because, you know, he existed in a world where, like, even fans would have conflicting information, mm-hmm. you know, that they print. So, like, there's a lot of sussing that out. And so the editor was ready to, she said she was going to slit my throat because I was, I think, a week or 2 weeks behind on it. And I was explaining, like, this is really hard to put this information together. But I don't know what part it was in there, but she said a part of it made her cry. And she said that it was, you know, she was impressed. She's still going to kill me. But, that was good. That had an impact on her.
Well, if folks don't have it, you know, the Black Friday sale is coming up for both Severin and Vinegar Syndrome, so you can pick it up then if you don't already have it. It's got, 30 films, I think?
Damn.
It's got a lot. Yeah, it's quite a bit because they went all the way.
20 films. Yeah, 20 films on 10 discs, 30 hours of special features. That's where
it has all most of his adult films, too, right?
Yeah, no. Most of...
No?
It has four of adult
No, films. There's like eight, I think, on there. I spent Monday. I took Monday off work, and I spent most of my day watching Steckler porn. I watched four in a row.
I've never done that many.
That was a lot.
Yeah, you had some Pepto-Bismol.
Yeah, I had to take a break. It was, you know, it was a moment.
I mean, if we can jump right into talking about the porn stuff, there was another writer on this that specifically focused on Steckler's porn, because to me, like, there's an innocence to the work by this guy that is part of what I love about him. And I couldn't take the leap into porn with him because I like this kind of like childish approach that he had to creativity.
I haven't seen any of his porn work either, but it'd be like if Ted V. Michaels or something started doing or did have some adult films in his catalog. I don't know if I'd want to watch it.
Yeah, right. I'm with you. Like, when I watched a few, and, you know, Carolyn Brandt is in some of these films as well. And it's like, it's disheartening to see her in that. And I was like, too, Carolyn, come on. Like,
she's not like doing things in them, though.
I saw a dick in a mouth, but it could have been another woman that looked a lot like her, but I don't know, but she's in a lot of them. But for the most part, she's just asking Nazis where Hitler's bunker is and, that sort of thing. So
I knew she acted in them and I knew that she wasn't excited about that shift in his career. Right.
Yeah.
And
then,
And, you know, then they had kids that were around by that point. And mm-hmm. so it's kind of like, I don't know. I just choose to pretend that, like, you know, they're in like this genital free, like, you know, happily, like, happily married world yeah. that somehow led to divorce. But yeah, like the porn stuff, I just couldn't do it. And they were sympathetic to my weird hangups about it. And so, like, they brought in this other guy who was writing a large, like, full-length biography of Steckler, like a really comprehensive one.
Oh, yeah?
He's been working on it, yeah. Nice.
Charles Devlin.
Yeah, Charles Devlin, who I never met, but he was, like, a really, like, you know, easy guy to do the collaboration with, because he basically is like, well, I can fill in those gaps, and because I think he's primarily fascinated by the 70s stuff of Steckler, which is when all the porn happened.
I mean, I think, like, that decade of sex films is interesting, and the fact that someone like Steckler got into that game. But I'm also yeah. with you, where it's like, when I think of him, I think of his more innocent films, like yeah. his more childlike and goofy kind of roles. Like, I mean, my introduction to him was Ratfink Boo Boo. I just thought it was like the silliest thing, and I had no idea who Steckler was, and I was like, what the fuck is this? But I still loved it. I ended up naming my last dog after Boo Boo, and I could never get her to wear that costume, though. I tried a few really? Times. I tried the makeshift little, thing. Yeah, the wind-up antennas and everything. She never tolerated costumes, unfortunately. But so for me, like, when I think of him, I think of these films. And I think right. most people do as well. I think just like the sex films that they do, that's something that a lot of people had to fucking, you know, a lot of low budget people had to do it. Wes Craven did it. Like, I mean, a lot of them did. I don't bemoan him for doing it. I'm sure he probably made the most money he did in his career yeah, by doing probably, that. Yeah. But I mean, they're not my favorite.
Yeah. I mean, I think it says a lot, like, when somebody goes from obscurity and, like, you know, struggle to probably some kind of marginal success at something, and then chooses to go back into the struggle. You know what I mean? It's yeah. like you come out of a tornado and it's like a perfect place. You're like, let's check out that tornado again. Like, it's like, you know, like, obviously his heart was in something else, you know? And so I just, like, I'm like, if this wasn't his favorite thing, and it's not, if it's the thing that kind of maybe broke up his family and all this stuff, it's like, I don't want to, yeah. I don't want to just simmer in that, you know?
Yeah.
Anymore. And I really, but it was really mostly just like looking at him as like a, you know, as kind of like a naive genius, you know, and like how he approached making movies, you know, and then to have that be like kind of hitched onto this thing that would make money no matter how badly it was made or who was creating it. Yeah, just that seemed like it might endanger that magic for me. So, and I just wasn't ready for that. Like, I need as much magic as possible. This world is shit.
Like Jerry's character in this says, the world's like depressing. It's in a depressive state.
Yes. Yeah. You know, we did tell folks last episode that this is going to focus on one of, I mean, well, I know I did warn people that we're mostly just going to be talking about Steckler, but we did point folks to The Incredibly Strange Creatures Who Stopped Living and Became Mixed Up Zombies from 1964.
Look, then run for your life. Incredible is the word for the world's first monster musical. See in magnificent Eastman color, the daring, dancing, enticing, and horrifying, the incredibly strange creatures who stopped living and became mixed-up zombies. From the innocence of music and laughter comes the twilight of terror. Along the midway, scantily clad dancers luring the young lovers into the sideshows. See the dancing girls of the carnival murdered by the incredible night creatures of the midway.
I will know that something evil lies ahead for me.
An unspeakable pit of dismal subhuman monsters who drool and gibber, moaning for the thrill of revenge. Incredible are the songs, the gaiety, the zombie stomp of those who will stop living. And then the mix-up, trickery, and the device to ruin. See the hunchback of the Midway fight a duel of death with the mixed-up zombies. Turning men into monsters, twisted, tormented human vultures, yearning to kill. Incredible creatures clutching at the thin thread of their miserable lives. Human vultures, only the weird zombies remain. Who is the woman branded in birth wearing the wart of horror?
Do as Madame Estrella said.
The world's first monster musical. The incredibly strange creatures who stopped living and became mixed up zombies.
This is also an interesting film to me just because of a lot of what Steckler did when this was released, how many different film names this movie has, like all of those things, the connection to Kubrick in this. And, you know, Steckler's connection to multiple Oscar winners, especially in this film, particularly, not just, you know, having a conversation with Kubrick about the name because of Dr. Strangelove, but, you know, specifically like the camera workers on this film.
Yeah, they're both. I mean, well, yeah, they both went on to.
Joseph Mischelli, who wrote basically the textbook for cinematography that people still use today. Vilmos Zsigmond, who's...
He's probably the most well-known.
Yeah, I think so. Like, he's worked with De Palma, Altman. Do you like Altman? I hate Altman.
I think Popeye's his best movie.
Okay.
Set design in Popeye. Like, I want to...
It's still there.
I know. I want to visit that place. It's amazing.
Yeah, he's got like he's got all these people working for him that or all these people connected to this film rather that are like Oscar winners. And there's this sort of Roger Corman element to it where it's like, who is what's it?
The Proving Ground thing.
Yeah. Where it's like, you know, you're gonna meet Roger Corman on your way up and on your way down kind of thing in the industry. And like Steckler is kind of in that mix too, where you have all these people who went on to like win Oscars and all that sort of thing.
And simultaneously, he's working with all these people that were like him. You know what I mean? It's because like Roger Corman, there's no peer to Roger Corman, right? He's like the only him that has ever been. But like Steckler is working with people who are going to go on to like great renown and respect in Hollywood. But then he also, like one of his first jobs when he moved to California was to work with Timothy Carey on World's Greatest Sinner, who's like also this weird outsider, like maniac auteur guy, you know, who like the thought of them working together is it's impossible, you know, like because they're both these weird geniuses who don't know what they're doing and don't care what the expectations are. And it's like the thought of like those two together is like unreal because they worked on he was on World's Greatest Sinner just as a cinematographer, so he was the Zsigmond in that situation. But I don't know. It's just it's that there's no record of what their collaboration was like, but it had to be like total chaos. Like,
yeah,
I don't know. Cause I mean, you know, Timothy Carey was like, Steckler was a very reserved guy that was like socially adept, I think, enough to like maneuver around without causing a scene. But, you know, Timothy Carey was like larger than the earth, you know, like he was like this, I don't know if anyone's familiar with him, but he was this guy who was like character actor that also in him had all these ideas and like screenplays, and he directed a movie, and like it's like nothing else that exists. It's coming out on Criterion.
Really? Yeah.
Which movie?
World's Greatest Sinner.
Oh, wow.
But I mean, and he hired a 19-year-old to do the music. It was Frank Zappa on his first job ever.
It's amazing.
Like he just was like pulling in all these like weird outside humans. So anyway, it's like Steckler is like, yeah, he just somehow got in the orbit of, or vice versa, all of these people that are unbelievable, but he never somehow personally learned how to adapt what he did to be more palatable to the average viewer, right? Even though he had all these experiences with like geniuses and nuthouses and all these people.
One of the things that you wrote in your sort of the introduction to it was that, you know, there are essentially like seven stories that just get retold, rehashed, you know, throughout film, throughout fiction, novels, whatever they may be. And that Steckler tells none of those stories.
It's true. Like it's his stuff. I mean, even his linear movies, like Wild Guitar and Thrill Killers is a pretty linear movie, right? It's a lot like The Sadist, which is funny because Vilmos Zsigmond also did the cinematography on The Sadist.
Yes.
But it's a... those are his movies that are his normal ones. And even those, like there's what you're left with when you have finished watching that movie isn't the structure of the film, but it's just like the really bizarre approach to that structure, I think, removes it from being what the movie's actually about. You know, like, it's no longer about what it's about. It's about the fact that there's a guy named Steak, you know, it's like whatever. In Wild Guitar, for example, you know, like Steckler's in that movie as a guy named Steak, and they're like, he shows up with a steak in his hand. And so
he says, like, I mean, it's genius. It's what it is.
So he's like, you're going to have steak at like 7 a.m.? He's like, what else is there?
Yeah.
It's like, you know, it's just like really amazing stuff like that wouldn't take place in any other movie.
Yeah. Did you ever have a chance to meet him?
We talked on the telephone twice.
Yeah.
And I much to my then wife's chagrin, I think I scheduled a unwanted detour to Las Vegas to visit him at his video store after spending Thanksgiving with my grandparents. And he died a week before that. And as it's still the case for me, I didn't find out about it till like later. So I got there hoping to meet him. Oh, and he had passed away a week earlier.
Oh, yeah. Shit. Wow.
Yeah, which that sucked. But it's kind of, I don't know. It's like, I'm also kind of grateful, you know, like that I...
Meeting your heroes kind of thing.
Yeah, which has always gone well for me. Like, I'm fortunate, I guess. Yeah. Like, nobody spit in my face. But, like, is he doesn't belong, like, in, you know, among the human race to me. Like, he's, like, one of the few people that, like, seemed to, like, kind of create himself and, like, forge his path in a way that I really respect. So it's, like... Like, I wouldn't have wanted to meet Timothy Carey either, because if he was having an off day or if he was tired, like, I wouldn't.
It could be the worst, yeah.
Yeah, he wouldn't be the deity that he is to me, you know? And, like, I don't believe in the hero worship in general, but, like, I got a couple exceptions, I guess, you know?
Yeah.
But, like, or Charles Bronson, like, that's got to, I would not want to meet him. Like,
So, I mean, you mentioned before we started recording that, like, you know, you were surprised that this movie in particular was the focus of it.
I'm not surprised. I mean, it's his most well-known
movie,
right?
Right. But it's not your favorite of his films. Do you have one in particular, do you think?
Yeah, I do. Well, my favorite of his movies in that it represents him the best is one that you talked about a minute ago, which is Ratfinka Boo Boo. Mm-hmm. Because he had, like, I think he did a couple things really well that represent him. One was to do things that were, like we said, he's like innocent, kind of like I approach things the way like a 12-year-old mm-hmm. might just say, like, well, I want this to exist, so I'm gonna make it exist. Like, I don't know how, I don't have any money, like, I'm just gonna do the thing, you know, kind of like the way the Little Rascals would build things, like, you know what I mean, like that's how he built a movie.
Yeah. Right.
And it's like well, we want to have a two-story office building, so like, got some cardboard and, you know, some sticks. And he just did it, and like, I love that. And then also, he would try to do things where it was like seedy, and like try to do things that were like, you know, more of a crime movie or a horror film or the darkness. But his darkness was so light; it was so vibrant and so like family friendly. Usually, you know, aside from the porn. And Ratfinka Boo Boo starts as this violent crime film that is really totally innocuous and G-rated, and then in his style of just building things out of nothing, he got halfway through the movie and realized that he didn't really enjoy it. He didn't like where it was going. So literally, like, halfway through a feature film, it becomes a completely different movie about two bumbling superheroes, like, that aren't even definitely not part of the fabric of the first half of that movie in any way.
Yeah,
it's odd because they pull because Ratfink is a popular singer who has sold like 10 million records.
Lonnie Lord,
yeah. I love how he just flips it on a dime.
Yeah. Like that. So yeah, there's this popular singer and his girlfriend is kidnapped by men who love to kill women indiscriminately. Right. And that's as far as they got. It takes about 40 minutes to get that far. Yeah. So the pacing is gradual until Lonnie Lord, like 10 million, you know, gold album winner. Lonnie Lord jumps in the closet with his gardener and they pop out as two superheroes. Who then fight an ape and three murderers to rescue his girlfriend. And like, that was the second Steckler movie I ever saw. And I was, this is like, like, I need more of this. I was so excited.
What was the first you saw?
The first one I saw was The Thrill Killers. And that's a funny story too, because that was a movie that Camp Video put out on VHS, oversized box. And the cover they got, they found some still of somebody who got their head, like, I mean, it's from a movie. It wasn't real, but so we got their head.
But like, it was like a photograph, not a drawing or anything.
Yeah. It was like an off registered, like, oversaturated, bloody as hell, like, image from something of somebody who, you know, as an axe murderer in a bathroom. I remember there's urinals covered in blood. And I was like, whoa, this movie looks intense. I'm 14. Like, I'm edgy, you know?
Yeah.
And I rented it, and it was a black and white, pretty bloodless movie, although there's a wild decapitation in there. And that was my first exposure to, I mean, I was like, at first angry. I'm like, this is supposed to be 80s gore, you know, not 60s, like, you know, like, maniacs, 60s maniacs versus 80s maniacs. You don't get a lot of blood usually.
Right.
But it felt like, what's weird is that the movie, like, the characters didn't feel as dangerous. Like, the gore wasn't as vicious, but you could tell the movie was made like by the seat of someone's pants, and that made it feel dangerous in a way, like weird. Like, was this supposed to get released? Like, am I supposed to be watching this? Like, you know, and in hindsight, like, that's one of his, you know, more professionally presented movies. Like,
yeah.
Like, more professionally made. And I mean, he has stuff that's like way more garage production than that one. But at the time I was like, wow, this is loose. Like, this is weird. Cause I'd seen Blood Feast and that feels safer. That feels more coherent and like it wasn't beamed in from somebody's subconscious, but like most of Steckler's stuff is just like, is straight from some dusty corner of his brain to the viewer. Like, you know, it's his unfiltered output is like what makes him who he is, you know? After seeing Rat Fink, that's really a great example of like, nobody stood in the way of this guy, even by, you know, in theory, when they should have, they didn't. And so then you get Rat Fink, which is like, you know, this Siamese twin of a movie. Both halves need the other half to exist, but neither one of those halves would have been excusable by, you know, anyone's, you know, definition of what movies were. And then to squish those together, they're so different.
Yeah.
It even the movie changes. It's a black and white movie that somehow changes color.
Yeah. It becomes like more pink and
purple. Like a sepia thing. It's such a different movie. It's such a mismatch that even the film stock can't hang out with the first half of the movie.
You know? I think I read in the booklet that he wanted to shoot Rat Fink in color, but they were short like $500. And so they had to shoot it in black and white.
Right. But the solution was to process it where everything had a tint. Because like, that's the same price. You know, that doesn't cost anything. So it's like, now it's bluish. Now it's, you know, now it's like reddish, you know, and that was so weird too. Cause the first half is all just black and white. I mean, there's some stuff that looks good. Like the film noir-ish opening of the woman running down the alleys and stuff like that all looks professional. But then suddenly it's like, red tinted film, a guy in his underwear is running around being like, well, look out, you know, and he's like, whoa. Yeah, the voices too. It's like, I mean, everything is done the way, you know, like a really creative 12-year-old would do it. And it's not, that's not a comment on his intellect. It's a comment on his, on his, like his inability to understand his limitations, which is a total compliment to him.
Yeah. I mean, that's some, like, that's how children think. Like, they don't think about what the barriers are.
Right.
They just are like, I want to do this, therefore I will do this to make that happen. Whereas an adult, you have been let down way too many times and you understand like, oh, okay, well, I can't do it because of
this. And create your own limitations.
Yes.
And if he was missing, if there's one thing missing from Ray Dennis Steckler's brain, it was that it was the self-limitations. It was like, you know, so like, again, that is the secret of his success, in my estimation, what I would call his success, like, was that he never, ever fell victim to thinking he couldn't do something.
Yeah. Because I listened to the commentary on Blood Shack, his commentary, Steckler's, and he would just flat out say, like, I would just film shots. We'd run out of film, but I know exactly how much film we had, but I would just film random shots because I didn't know what the movie was going to be, how it was going to end. I just wanted to basically make it at least an hour long. He just went for it. I mean, he just filmed it and was going to make a movie no matter what, which I just love.
And it's crazy to think, like, I mean, everyone who's really into movies has like a critical eye. Like, it's our job. We can't help but curate. He never thought about people's reaction to the work because he just like was driven to do it regardless of whether or not it had an audience. And he was fortunate enough to find people that somehow would make that happen. I mean, these weren't like high rollers, but you know, he'd find somebody that would give him $2,000. He's like, I can make a movie for $2,000. Right. Like, let's do it. And he never really feared the public's reaction or like, he didn't care what critics thought at all. Like, that wasn't even a factor. And then it's ironically, these movies like have been released now on every home video format, like throughout the years, like they continue to exist, even though they were not, you know, he wouldn't have cared less if that movie didn't make it to Blu-ray, you know what I mean? It didn't matter. Like because he had accomplished it. He had shown it to his children and his wife. They had enjoyed it. And then that was it. That's all he needed.
Right.
If you draw a picture that you think is good, like, do you need it to be distributed to the public? Or is it just, you know, who was that for?
Right.
You know?
Well, I think today, you know, I'm talking about you young kids out there who need to have everything in their life, not just for themselves, but like documented on Instagram and making sure that the world can see, like, here's this thing I did. Here's me doing this thing kind of thing. And I think what you're talking about with Steckler isn't just like unique to him, but something from an older generation that is like, I can be satisfied with the work that I've done for myself. I don't need
validation.
Yeah. I don't need that from the outside world. And I think, but his is a much more extreme case because not only does he have he doesn't need the validation. He doesn't have any sort of limitations like we talked about. And he has that sort of childish mindset, which right. makes him unique. And I think almost any director that I've ever come across.
Yeah, because, you know, we're talking about these series of box sets that have been coming out. And not like from a specific company, but there's just more interest in people who were these self-motivated, like auteur filmmakers, right? But if you look at the other guys, like Andy Milligan knew what the audience was. He kind of knew what they wanted. He took pleasure in not giving it to them sometimes, but he understood the game. And like Al Adamson was all about business. He was like, I make movies for drive-in movie theaters mm-hmm. with shocking names that titillate the public and they're curious and they come and see you know, Brain of Blood or whatever. But like, those are all things that, you know, showed a certain amount of calculation. And Steckler was just like, okay, I made a movie. He walked away and he didn't care about distribution. He didn't really care. Wasn't concerned about the money, according to his widow. You know, she's like, I wish he was more concerned about money, but like, he just wanted to share the story, even if he didn't write the story until the movie was already made.
Right.
Yeah.
Like, that was enough for him, you know?
Yeah, that was another reason that he said that he filmed so many things, because he had no idea where the story was going, how it was going to end. So he was going to piece these scenes together.
He just wanted to show you the trooper.
Thank you.
And give you the, and let me just talk about the trooper, because the trooper is an ongoing thing throughout his career. It's a weird thing. Trooper is in multiple movies.
I mean, he's definitely the inspiration. It got to be from Incredibly Strange Creatures when he's hypnotized with a hoodie.
Yeah, that's where it starts.
Yeah.
He just wanted to carry on like this weird little mythology he's created around this nonsensical thing called a trooper. And he wanted to, and he had just seen that old shack out in Nevada, and he's like, oh, that gives me a feeling. When I look at that weird old abandoned house, I have a certain feeling.
And that old water tower.
Yeah. And I want to put that feeling on film. And that was the goal. No other filmmaker, like you said, I can think of, would make a movie around that. Like, oh, that gives me a feeling. Let me drop everything, drag my family out here, and like do this, and then figure out what it is later. You know, like it's like that's
yeah. You get like, because I the only commentary I've listened to with Steckler was Blood Shack, and just hearing him talk and watch his own movie, he's so excited about everything.
Yeah.
Which is so contagious. But he'll like a shot will pop up. He's all, look at that. I mean, that could be from a John Ford movie. You know, he knows that it's all pieced together and stuff, but he's so excited that he made this work of art. I mean, but it's not necessarily for a bunch of people. It's making him incredibly happy. And that should be what it's about for artists.
Yeah. He's not self-impressed. He's just excited that the thing exists, which is like, that was the goal in the first place. And he's never, it's funny. He's never pretentious about it. He's never trying to pretend that it's more than it is either.
Right.
You know, like he's never, like when he says that could be a shot from a John Ford movie, he's really just, it's been long enough where he can look at something objectively and say, that's nice. Look at that. That's not so bad. Like, hey,
I did
right.
that, yeah.
Yeah, but I don't know. It's just, there's something about him. Yeah, it's so sweet. One of the last things he did was just like a home movie. He went back to the town he's from, Reading, Pennsylvania. And he made this like mostly silent movie that's just like little snapshots of this town, and it's not for public consumption, but it's on the set. But it's just like him kind of wandering around, and then he says this thing. I don't know why this affects me at all. It's probably gonna sound stupid, but the first time you hear anyone say anything, it's like an hour into this movie, it's just like people mumbling and wandering around Reading, Pennsylvania, and he suddenly turns, Steckler's there, he turns to the camera, which his wife was holding, his second wife, and he smiles and he goes, I'm here, can you see me? And it's just him in like the open. And I think he was just asking if the camera was working or something. But he left it in, I think, as just like him saying, like, I still exist. Like, I've made my life has been like devoted to this weird singular vision that I have. And he's like, if you want to be along for this ride, that's great. You know, it's like, that's the way he says that. That's right. Like, I was like, wow, that really hit me. I don't know. I guess that's a silly thing. I read way too much into it, but it felt like, he was summing up what he'd done. And that was like one of the last things he ever did. So I thought that was really weird. Yeah. And to make that the only line of audio in the movie, like it had to mean something.
I think it does. Yeah. Lance, what's your like Steckler journey been like the last couple of weeks?
Well, I mean, I'd never dove into Steckler before at all, really. I watched his, I guess he co-directed or I don't know how it worked, but Ted V. Michael's The Street. Angels of Vengeance or Angel of Vengeance.
Oh, yeah.
I watched that for our blood orgies, of She-Devils. And then from there on, the last couple of days, of weeks, I watched The Thrill Killers, which was my first kind of true, it was my first Steckler. and I loved it. I was kind of floored by it.
I mean, that's him with the best of his collaborators. Three Colors it's like his best looking movie, I think. I mean, it's shot like a real crime film of the 60s, you know, like.
But like you said before, the bet one, a great decapitation, it throws in unexpectedly this yeah, gore like and
grisly moment.
It's not like gory at all, but yeah, there's these unexpected moments where you're like, holy shit, this is the greatest 60 movie ever.
it's pretty intense. And on the scenes of Steckler himself playing the mad dog.
Yeah.
And like, you know, there's a famous scene where he like basically kills a towards the beginning, but like those are shot really well and they're really intense. And then some of his best collaborators were playing the two of the maniacs that are in the movie, like the thrill killers themselves. I mean, one is Gary Kent, who passed away recently. He's an Austin guy. He's like, he's an amazing, you know, multi-talented, you know, like stuntman and an actor and writer and director and all this stuff. And he plays like the big oversized, like muscular
maniac.
Yeah. And he's really great in the movie. And then Steckler's acting teacher is the first of the thrill killers who dies, you know, poison coffee. But, and he was in a ton of stuff. He's in like half of Steckler's movies. He's in Cynthia the Devil's Doll. He's like this subtle actor who seems like he'd almost be like in comedy. You know, he's like a New York comedic Jewish actor type guy, but he's so good and he's so subtle and the Carolyn Brandt is very central.
Yeah.
In the movie. And it's just like, that's him like in his best, with his best collaborators and like under the best circumstances where he had some money, he had really good people on the tech side of the film. And it still feels like but you still definitely have that weird lone wolf, like I do things my own way thing, even in his most structured films, you know, like you can't escape his brain doing things differently. It's a, God, he's in, my brain keeps wanting to say Burt Gordon, but it's not, it's a name like that. He was in Steckler stuff all the way to the end. Because Steckler had a movie called Summer Fun that was basically just made for his daughter, starring her. And this guy's in Summer Fun as well.
Keith O'Brien? Robbins.
Herb Robbins, thank you. I just had seen Burt Gordon, Herb Robbins, I don't know. Anyway, so Herb Robbins is one of the thrill killers, and he's like the brains of the operation. And that's cool about Steckler is like he kills that guy first. So it's like, let me kill the brain of this movie. You know, like the victim. You know, and then he didn't realize when he was making the movie how good Herb Robbins was going to be as an actor. Cause you know, he was just a pretty general, like broad acting teacher, you know, he's like, he knows what he's doing. He'll be fine. And he brought him in and it's like, no, he's great. And he ended up being in as many Steckler movies as almost anybody. Carolyn Brandt takes the award on that. Yeah. It was just like, he's so good. Herb Robbins is so good. And then he was in turn inspired when he saw his acting student directing a movie and like, you know, being able to put this thing together just by a shoestring, it made Herb Robbins excited. And he ended up directing two movies, which he never planned on doing apparently before. So he did The Worm Eaters, which is like a psychedelic, surreal horror film that he did a whole William Castle style rollout on that movie where he had people eating worms in the lobbies of the theater.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, it was amazing. But he was inspired by seeing Steckler just do this shit, you know, like go out on his own and do it. And then right before he died, he made a movie called Brain Sucker, which is like a Mad Magazine style, like 1990, like horror comedy with like, you know, trombone sounds and stuff.
Yikes.
Yeah. I mean, I love all the, like the fake names that they have, you know, Cash Flag and
Atmos. Oh my God.
But there's a Brick Bardo in the very beginning of Thrill Killers.
Here we go.
That's Doll Man. That's Tim Thomerson's like in Albert Pune's Doll Man. His name, the character's name is Brick Bardo. So when
they
I
took
saw
that from that?
I don't know. I
mean, had to. There's no accidental double Brick Bardo.
Yeah, that's what I feel. I mean, it's such a good name. And
I should know this.
I mean, that's why I kind of wanted to bring it up to see if you knew if it was, there was a tie-in or if it was stolen from that or.
Well, I watched Doll Man once. I already had a bitterness towards Charles Band by that point. I was really frustrated that his obsession with tiny things was way out of control. So I think Doll Man was
bad channel, the dynamic.
They shrink people in bad channels, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So even like, yeah, but he had so many, I counted one time. So like 10 years ago, Charles Band, this is a little diversion here, but it's like 10 years ago, Charles Band had already produced, I think, 74 movies about tiny things that are that are a threat to us. Yeah. I'm like, what is wrong with him? Like, you know, like this all little like dwarfy monster stuff, like so many.
He could be like a hypochondriac or something, and it all means something, like
not
diseases.
Paying for like actual actors to be the villains, but instead getting little puppets, little puppets and dolls and things like that.
Yeah,
but then that costs money, though.
Not as much as like an actor, I would think. I mean, that's like one of the things that Joe Bob Briggs pointed out in like a couple of the commentaries on the set is how nearly every Steckler movie, if there is any sort of killer or horror element, it's all strangulations. And he's like, I don't know why that is. And I'm like, I do. He didn't want to pay for props. Like,
well, he has a murder technique that I respect. You see it a lot in the Hollywood Strangler meets the Skid Row.
I like that.
I do too. I love that movie. I watched that one recently. But yeah, it's basically a stab.
Yeah.
Either it's strangulation or it's a stab, and the victim just profusely just bleeds from the mouth.
Yeah, like super dense, foamy pudding like blood. Weird blood viscosity in these films, I'll tell you.
I think his Steckler's commentary, I think it was for the Las Vegas serial killer one. But it wasn't my favorite because a lot of it was like he didn't remember a lot of people's names and he would just, you know, he'd be like just sort of narrating what was happening on screen and just like.
It seemed like they probably did too many in one day.
Yeah.
There's a little bit of that in Bloodshack where he's like, I think, I never know.
Yeah. I mean, that's fine. For Bloodshack, there's just. It's fine.
That's like a 2-page script on it.
Yeah. If that. But it got a little tedious listening to a few of them, which is why I did some of the Joe Bob commentaries. I was
which are good. Really good.
They are, Incredibly Strange Creatures commentary was really good.
Yeah.
The Bloodshack one that Joe Bob did was really good.
And which is crazy.
It's like the best way for me to watch it. You know, I'm like, I just couldn't help it.
So. No, he was people think Joe Bob's a great personality. And, very funny, but his knowledge of
it's insane.
Yeah, like because to be able to talk to fill the space in Bloodshack, which is 97% space, is like it's a miracle, you know?
Yeah,
like he's a superhuman. And I think that the fact that they were able to use those commentaries, which were done for a previous version of these releases, you know, it's really important. Like, I think Joe Bob Briggs is a treasure that people. I think his personality is so big, like, which is a good thing, that it keeps him on television and everything.
Sure.
But it makes people not realize just how much he actually loves these movies. You know? And knows about them. And like, he's a global treasure, that man.
What else have you watched in the last couple of weeks, Lance?
That was about it. I mean, the Incredibly Strange Creatures, Thrill Killers. Yeah. The Skid Row Slasher, Bloodshack, Ratfinkaboo-Boo.
What did you think of Ratfinkaboo-Boo?
I mean, I loved it.
Okay.
Like we've already talked about like, the way it just completely switches gears and it's like let's turn this into these fumbling comedy my favorite scene is when they announce that who they are. This is a job for Ratfinkaboo.
No, but they don't say that. They go, this is a job for you know and who.
Yeah. And then they go into the like you know the bedroom or the closet or whatever.
Yeah.
And they can't open the door and they're fumbling stuck. The door and I'm like this is.
It's great.
I love this.
And everything before that is like misogynist, like murder fantasy. Yeah. And then suddenly it's this like kindergarten superhero comedy.
Dude walking around with the chain, like killing, like the villains, they have good looks. The villains in Ratfinkaboo-Boo, they look great.
Even when they're running around with a gorilla at the end.
Yeah. And the guy who, you know, who owns the gorilla.
Bob Burns. Oh.
They kiss at the end.
Yeah. There's a very effeminate man with a pet gorilla walking around in the mountains.
Yeah.
That's a weird character. The guy who played Boo Boo was himself like he was like you know a sub Steckler would be filmmaker. He only made one movie ever. He was he was good friends with James Bryan, who was also like an outsider guy who started with porn and then went into doing narrative movies. The guy who did Lady Street Fighter and Don't Go in the Woods.
Yeah.
And like they were trying to form a company that was going to be Steckler, and he said, "Oh, Titus Moody." It looks like Mode, but it's M-O-E-D-E, it pronounced Moody. And eventually he just changed his last name to be the word Moody because, you know, it's easier. But Titus Moody was Boo Boo. So he was basically, in the movie, he is Lonnie Lord, famed musician. His girlfriend, C.B. Beaumont, has a gardener. So the movie's about a superhero who's a pop musician who teams up with his girlfriend's gardener to fight crime. Right?
Yeah.
And so that's Boo Boo. And Titus Moody is Boo Boo, who's also in Wild Guitar. He's like a really funny, scrawny, like pencil neck character actor guy. But he was also so inspired by spending time around Steckler that he's like, I'm going to do this. So him and James Bryan and then kind of maybe Steckler who was never totally sold on this, were going to start this company called Movietron. And they were going to make a movie poster as well as they could, you know, which was maybe not professional, but, you know, sure, as well as they could, and then try to sell the movie on the strength of that poster and then have to go make the movie. So they would tell somebody, this movie exists, do you want it? And they'd be like, sure, we'll buy that, $5,000. They're like, great. And then they'd like have a week to make the movie. That was going to be their business model. And which sounds ridiculous, like, that, how could you ever pull that off? Except everything Empire Pictures ever did.
Yeah.
Was done that way.
Yeah.
Like, literally, truly, that's what happened. Like, TerrorVision was a poster before they ever had a script. Like, you know, all these things. And so it was kind of brilliant. But at the time, it was like, you guys are idiots. Like, this isn't going to happen. You know, and then it became an actual working business model for a while. Under, yeah. I don't know. Charles Band has to keep coming up. That guy.
Yeah.
Love-hate relationship going on.
Yeah.
I mean, I know you guys are both big fans of Evil Bong 7, but
yeah.
Yeah. So we got, yeah.
I unashamedly love Doll Man.
Fine. Tim Thomerson, sure.
You don't love Doll Man versus Demonic Toys. I don't believe you.
No, I don't. Okay. I mean, I do have, I think you gave me that set. Demonic Toys, Doll Man. It's like a 7 DVD.
That has really no coherent bond.
Yeah, you just flip through it. It's a bunch of Charles Band Empire. So it's, yeah, just Doll Man. I could watch that all day long. It's like a cool, 78 minutes or something?
What about Trancers?
I love Trancers. I love Trancers.
Trancers 1 is amazing.
Yeah.
So good. Dry hair is for squids.
It's amazing.
What does that mean? That's a crazy talk they have. Yeah, it's just, I don't know. All these people, it's like everyone found inspiration in this guy that was making no money and doing things super unprofessionally, which I love that. Yeah. like Titus Moody, like, changed his career. Like, Herb Robbins changed his career. All these people did this because they're like anyone has the right to put their ideas into the world.
Like, yeah, I bet working with Stucco was just so, like,
freeing.
Yeah, it was so inspiring. And you're like, I can do that. Like, this is, it's nothing but a joyful experience.
There's no script, probably. Yeah. It's just like, he would show up and he was like, I don't know what we're doing tomorrow, but here's what we're going to do today. And it's like, what a way to live, you know?
He wanted people to feel like they could do that.
Yeah.
Yeah, mostly, you know, there's a lot of gatekeeping, I think, in the arts, you know, like a lot of people saying, like, oh, you think you can write poetry? Well, like, try writing poetry like I do. It's just like, it's just a bunch of crap. You know, it's just like, everyone can do everything. It's John Rad was the director of that movie Dangerous Men that took 25 years to finish.
Yeah.
And he always kept going against everyone's wishes. You know, his family was like, please stop making this movie on weekends, Dad. Like, you know, you don't love us, you know, whatever. Like, you know what I mean? But he was so devoted to this idea of finishing this movie. And he was on a public access talk show about gay culture, even though he wasn't gay and nothing in the movie was. But that was the only press that was interested in talking to him. So he was very happy to go on the show.
Yeah.
And the host said, this movie is fascinating. You spent 25 years making this action movie. It doesn't really make a lot of sense. And why did you do that? And this to me says something about Steckler and about all these people who just forge forward against all odds. And John Rad said, they told me to make this feature film is impossible. And I said, impossible is impossible. And I think that's like the greatest thing to say. Like, he's like, he just didn't believe in that. He didn't agree.
Yeah. You know?
And I'm like, that man, that's like, that was Steckler too. He's just like, well, who says I can't make 4 movies about troopers? I'm not going to listen to that.
Yeah.
So we've hit on this a couple of times. Can we do like a little trooper sidebar real quick?
Yeah.
So beginning in Incredibly Strange Creatures, somehow Steckler decided that like the ultimate face of evil is a guy wearing a hooded sweatshirt that's kind of pulled down around his face. So your face is like a little donut in the middle, right?
Yeah.
And even though he made other movies with monsters and stuff in them, Steckler made other horror films, whatever, it would always come back to the trooper. And even in this movie he made that was a science fiction film for children, which is Lemon Grove Kids Meet the Monsters, all hell is breaking loose. There's a vampire woman who's come from Venus to
the grasshopper in the spaceship.
Right. And she's got her sidekick as a human or like a humanoid grasshopper who can whistle you to death. And so all this hell breaks loose and everybody's like, oh my God, the vampire woman from Venus is here. Oh, shoot. You know, and everyone's running around. And then the trooper just is like, shows up and it's like wandering around. You're like, oh my God. And then suddenly it's not Steckler with the hooded sweatshirt, but now it's Herb Robbins with the hooded sweatshirt, you know? And they're like, oh my God, the trooper is like, you know, changing form. It's like, but it's like over the course of decades,
yeah,
the trooper came back. And if you look at the Incredibly Strange Creatures iteration of it, which is just like a normal person under hypnosis to become a murderer suddenly is a trooper.
Yeah.
You know, pulls down their hooded sweatshirt around their face and kills people. Then the entirety of Steckler's career had the through line of the trooper, because Incredibly Strange Creatures was like his first film that really showcased like what he does and who he is and his weird approach to everything.
Yeah.
So like, you know, he'd made Wild Guitar and stuff, but like his first horror film certainly is that one. And the trooper is there. It's kind of the origin of the trooper. And then the very last movie he ever made, which was a sequel to Incredibly Strange Creatures, is Steckler, age 70, you know, now overweight and elderly, with his hooded sweatshirt pulled tight around his face, holding a knife. And you're like, that's like, you believed in this,
wow,
in this image. Like, you created this iconic, ridiculous thing that means a lot to me now for some reason. Like, why is that? You know, it's like, I don't know. It's really cool. It's silly, but it's like, it's his own thing. It's like his own mythology that he made. And there he is on top left of the box, yeah, on the back cover. It's Steckler with his hooded sweatshirt on. Yeah. And it's like,
I mean, that's him on the cover too, without the hoodie. Like,
yes, yeah, that's like a thrill killer style. Yeah. But I just love that. It's like, it's the dumbest thing in the world. It's like if somebody you knew walked up to you when you were 15 years old and is like, there's a thing called the Forpert, and it's a guy who wears a bucket on his head, and the Forpert's going to kick you. And you're like, okay. And then you see that person, you guys are like, you know, 80 years old in a retirement home, and he just comes out with a bucket on his head and kicks you. And you're like, the Forpert is here.
Let's film a movie. I want to finish this up. Let's do it right now.
Like, I spent my life, you know, with this stupid thing that is now part of my heart.
Yeah.
You're like, I think it's beautiful.
I want to watch that.
Yeah. It's a beautiful thing. I don't know. He's, yeah. Behold, a new thing. As dumb as it is, yeah, I've done it. You know, and he totally did it.
So we've talked about Steckler and your favorite and your journey through it. So my journey in the last couple of weeks was just me filling in some gaps that I hadn't watching women get their gaps filled in for morning. I know. But I mean, I will say, like, I really should have just spaced them out a little bit, you know, just watching four Steckler pornos on a Monday morning is not the ideal way to spend it. But
that's why Garfield hates Mondays.
Yeah. So I watched Nazi Brothel, Secret Love Life of Hitler's Nazis, which was 90% reuse shots from Nazi Brothel. You know, but not as many flaccid penises as there were in Nazi Brothel. So yeah, just that's the one I did, I guess, enjoy was Count Alcom. That was fun. He's the nephew of Dracula and he's trying to pick up women with this how-to book and going around. And there's this moment at the end of it. Wait, is it that one? It's either this one or Love Life of a Sexy Vampire, where the end of it, the vampire ends up out in the sunlight and he dies. And of course, like we don't see him die, of course, no effects, but you see the cape there and the guy who comes up to him at the end looks up at the sun, or at least in like the direction of the sun, and just fucking middle finger, just straight at the sun, just like, fuck you, sun. And it's just legitimately hilarious. So there are some moments in it where like, They're enjoyable to watch outside of like the hardcore scenes and stuff like that, which are, you know, half of the Nazi porn films are women yelling at Nazis because they're flaccid. Like, why can't you get it up? And it's just like, oh my God, this is not why people watch porn. Like, I don't know who this is for. Like, it's a novelty porn. Like, it's not, no one's watching it to get aroused. No one's watching it for the comedy, even though they are comedies.
Right. It's like there's one person in the world who that's their thing, and somehow that movie came into existence for everyone else.
Sure,
to,
yeah. Or, yeah. That's what it is.
Somebody loves Nazis or something.
Flaccid Nazis.
Yeah.
That's their thing. That's the bag.
I won't kink shame you, don't worry.
Yeah. No kink shaming here.
No, we never do. Never do. So it was that, and I did get around to watching Lemon Grove Kids, which I thought was not necessarily my thing, but it is endearing. And then I think that was pretty much it, because I'd watched most of the ones that I'd wanted to talk about and that you watched this week. But then the rewatch of Incredibly Strange Creatures this time around was a lot of fun. There's some really fun moments in it. And I didn't know this until listening to Joe Bob's commentary on it, was that Atlas King was a recent immigrant from Greece who spoke like no English. And so all of the lines he delivered were delivered phonetically. That's amazing.
Oh, wow. Yeah. Well, it's, yeah. And yeah, he, Stekler moved to Hollywood and he, didn't make a lot of money working for Timothy Carey. So he had to like take on a roommate, like real short notice, like he was about to be homeless. And that was Atlas King, who didn't speak English at all, but they got along great. So Stekler would just like make breakfast in the morning, like bring him some food or whatever, you know, and Atlas King just would smile and nod. And that was like their entire relationship. And then he's like, you know, he's like, if I like this guy and I don't even know what he's saying, that means he's charismatic. Like that means that's going to come across on screen. And so he really thought this guy could be a leading man, even though he didn't even understand what the movie was about, you know? Yeah. And it is endearing, you know, like you watch the movie, like you like Atlas King, like he's killed in Thrill Killers. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And you get upset. Yeah. You actually care about this guy. Even though he's like, oh, wait, don't shoot me. Yeah. You know, it's like, but it's like, there's something that Stekler would see this thing in people. Oh gosh. Stop that chair. Stekler would see this thing in people that other people didn't see. And what's crazy about it, I think I touched on this a little bit at the end of the booklet, mm-hmm. is he did that in real life too. Like his video store, Bascot Video in Las Vegas, was staffed by winos and like homeless people that he met. And he would see something in that person and say like, oh, I trust him with my business. Like, I know he's a good man. And it's like, and that's how he cast his movies, but that's how he got cast his life, you know? And so his collaborators were like all like, you know, a lot of weirdos and, you know, people that wouldn't be cast by anyone else in movies for sure.
Yeah.
And he saw a thing in them that is the reason that we are talking about those movies now.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, and that's like, that's really incredible. Like that's like magical. It's funny because like very definitely the guy that was the last manager of the video store was a hobo. Like, I think he told me that Stekler let him sleep in his van. Like Stekler had an old brown van parked outside of the video store and this guy was sleeping in it. And after Stekler died, the video store held on for like 6 months and then moved into literally the janitor closet of the PO box, like the mailboxes, et cetera, type business in the same strip mall and was manned only by this homeless guy that Stekler had taken under his wing. And it was like, he was so devoted to him. It was beautiful. Like the guy carefully took the video store, shrunken down to like seriously like 6 feet by 5 feet. And so the guy got rid of all of the regular movies. Like, okay, we don't need Nurse Betty in this closet. You know, we don't need like this regular stuff. He's like, but he kept all the Stekler stuff and all the movies made by Stekler's friends, like all the other like weirdo guys.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
And he had it all for rent out of this closet in the back of this mailboxes store. And that's where, you know, and he had like Stekler movies, baseball caps. And
you got one of those.
Yeah. I bought one from him.
Oh, sweet.
Yeah. And he, that guy was in poor health. Like he could barely talk. He could barely breathe. Like he was wheezing, like everything hurt, but he showed up every day to like carry on the legacy.
That's amazing.
Yeah. It was so cool. Yeah.
So one of the things that Incredibly Strange Creatures is, I guess, famous for is being the first monster musical. So there's a lot of musical interludes, dance interludes, things like that.
Yeah, but it's not really a musical because it's just like footage of people on a stage like doing nightclub entertainment.
Yeah.
Like, it's not like suddenly the characters break into song while they're murdering each other or anything, but was it the first monster musical? I wonder. Like it seemed like there had to be something.
I mean, Carolyn Brandt in an interview and Stekler both said like this is the first monster musical. So I mean,
I guess it is.
It could be very well, but Lance, you're the fan of the musical elements when it comes to stuff like this.
Well, I think I had read that the budget for Incredibly Strange Creatures was about $38,000, something like that.
That's huge for him.
And after I watched the movie, I was like, okay, it all went to costumes for the dancers. Like the dance sequences are, I mean, they're well done. They're professional. Like those costumes could have already been like provided by, you know, the dance troupe or whatever.
Yeah. I just assume they were.
Carolyn Brandt said that one of the numbers where it's like these black and white striped ones, those were taken from a Moulin Rouge movie that had a Moulin Rouge set or was based on that or something like that. But all sort of repurposed everything. I think, money-wise, I'm sure it was like cast, crew, equipment.
I think the creature makeup looks great. I thought the creature makeups and the masks look great.
Oh yeah, the disfigured sidekick of the
gypsy. Ortega. Yeah, I'm going to be him for Halloween.
Yeah.
You're just going to dunk your face in some peanut butter and be like.
Like, was he, and I guess he was just like a scary guy with superhuman strength, or was he actually one of Madame Estrella's like?
Oh, I assume he was
like a creature. Like,
yeah, I assume he was just like a busted guy.
That's what I figured at first. But then I thought, I kept thinking about, like, was he one of the, like, is he one that's behaved and he doesn't have to be caged? Because he had superhuman strength, she said, right?
Yeah.
But yeah, the creature makeup, I wish there was more creature stuff. Have you guys read Sweet Tooth by Jeff Lemire? It's a comic book.
Mm-mm.
It's about like these human animal hybrid kids that, you know, they have like their experiments. But I haven't, there's a show apparently now, but I read the comic book and it reminded me, because when the creatures pop out in Incredibly Strange Creatures, they look like they have some sort of like animalistic, I know that it's like acid and stuff or however they're performed, but they look like animals to me. They look like hybrids.
So it's kind of like Island of Lost Souls almost. Like,
yeah.
Yeah.
But I just wish there was more, explained about the creatures. Are they just...
They're the mixed up zombies, and that's all.
But they're not like a freak show of the carnival.
No, she just keeps them in
that's her private collection.
Yeah,
which is strange.
I don't remember which commentary it was, but when those zombies finally break loose, that's when, like, if you were watching this in a theater, Steckler had like zombies running up and down the aisles, like breaking loose and havoc. So like. I would have loved to, you know, there's movies that I would love to go back in time and see. And like, you know, obviously a William Castle movie, something like that would have been so much fun. Like this kind of like interactive experience, like this whole new 4DX, whatever, like your seat moves when the thing happens. And I'm like, no, I want like
a ghost
flying through the top of the theater and like Steckler zombies running down the aisle. That would be my ideal, like go back in time and watch a movie in a theater.
And Steckler... He loved showmanship like that because, again, it was like about the human experience and not about, you know, the income or whatever. Like everything was like that. So when he first was making Thrill Killers, he was like, you know, I'm going to come with the movie. Like, you know, I'll roll it out so I can actually be there and attack the audience as Mad Dog. Like towards the end of the film, was run out with a knife and just be going for him. And then the movie somehow got... like a standard distribution deal, which, you know, exceeded their expectations when they were making it. And so he had Don Post, the mask company, make masks of his face. So employees of the theaters playing the film, since it was going to be playing simultaneously, you know, in different cities, they'd have like some 16-year-old like concessions kid put on a Ray Dennis Steckler mask and run around the theater with a knife.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
That's so cool.
That was included with the box set. Like if you got like the deluxe box set.
Oh, the mask?
The package. Like, you would get a Steckler mask. I don't think it glowed in the dark, because I think...
Yeah, he made it glow in the dark, so in the theater, you'd still be able to see that was Mad Dog.
Yeah.
Is there footage? I mean, there probably is some footage.
Probably not. Yeah, yeah.
That'd be amazing to see.
And so, but what probably happened more often than not, right, was that the theater received the film print, and inside was, like, a mask of this, like, weird bald guy with a big nose, you know? Yeah. And just like, what the hell is this? Just tossed it aside. Like, they don't know what that's for.
Yeah.
You know?
This package of this thing.
But that existed. Like, they made it.
That's amazing.
That's the coolest thing ever. It's like, I don't know. Because nobody would ever have done that who had like a rational understanding of the business,
right,
of theatrical exhibition. Nobody would ever okay that. But he wasn't looking for the okay. You know, he just never even considered it.
Yeah. Lance, what do you like about Incredibly Strange Creatures? Like, what are some standout moments and scenes or characters or anything like that for you?
You like Madame Estrella's whole...
I do. Thing. Like her kind of Elizabeth Taylor with the bad fake tan look. Mm-hmm. It looks good.
That's funny because I thought she reminded me of what's her name from Greece.
Rizzo. She reminded me of the...
Stalker Channing. Sorry.
Stalker Channing, yeah. Right. Yeah, it's like I was like, man, that's like that. It's just like Stalker Channing's mom. Or like, who is this lady? You know?
I thought that for a second too. But as she was like, I don't know, maybe because she's real diabolical. I kept thinking of Elizabeth Taylor.
80s
but,
Elizabeth Taylor, for sure, yeah. Spray tanned.
Yeah, very spray tan.
Yeah, and I guess that was a fake mole.
Yeah.
With like some hair and stuff.
Oh, yeah, that was like a 2-pound like Lemmy mole on her face.
Yeah.
The Ace of... Yeah, I mean, I liked all the characters. I mean, we already talked about like the trooper character that Steckler introduced at that point. I actually enjoyed the ending. I mean, I'm going to jump to the ending where, you know, I guess they go for like a tragic vibe with Jerry falling off, you know, into the water. I did read in a review, I don't know if you've heard about this, Zach, or if it's even mentioned on the commentary because I haven't watched it, but that Steckler in a book in an interview said that Black Orifice was like, he loved the movie and it was kind of an inspiration for Incredibly Strange.
But the things that he would have pulled from that movie would just be like colors.
And the carnival and stuff.
Yeah, see that. Yeah, like,
and the end, but because I did watch Black Orifice after I'd read that. I was like, I've never seen it. You know, I'll check this out. And it is like a tragic ending where he kind of falls off a cliff and stuff.
Yeah.
You know, spoiler alert for people who haven't seen it, but yeah, I enjoyed the ending. I liked seeing Steckler do his own stunts. Like, I thought he was going to twist an ankle jumping in through those rocks.
Oh,
like,
my God,
I mean, it was like, I liked the way it looked, and it ended on Madame Estrella's, you know, her fortune with people on the ground, on the beach, on the shores. I kind of wish it was, cause it pans out and, you know, Jerry's dead on the ground with everybody around him. I wish it panned out like, and it kept panning out into like a crystal ball. Like, boom. Dun, dun, dun. But yeah, I mean, just the whole vibe. I mean, the whole thing is just anything DIY. Like, I love, and this is definitely, you're going to make what you love. You're going to, no matter any budgetary limitations. So
yeah. Did you notice the blue wagon? Sorry. That's a super deep
that's
cut.
Old, yeah.
That's a deep cut for anyone who's been listening to Lance and I podcast for since the beginning of time.
The first movie we covered was Madhouse, and I kept noticing this blue car in the background when people were dying. I was like, that's the killer's blue car, but you never know.
Right.
I don't think Steckler has. Steckler just reused a bunch of his old cars. He liked to talk about it.
That was his own. That was his family wagon that's in there. So yeah,
it's in Thrill Killers too, I think.
Yes. And Sam Raimi, multiple cars.
Sam Raimi picked up that tradition.
Yeah. Yes.
Cause he's put his parents' station wagon in every movie he's ever made, including Quick and the Dead.
That's right. Laird pointed that out when he had that for Weird Wednesday recently.
Yeah, he's like, it was like something like there's, it's a Western, so there can't be any cars in it unless Alex Cox made it. But like they have a part. There's a bunch of explosives that are hidden under a blanket, and that was the car. Like he just had to squeeze it in somewhere. And it's like,
respect. That's yeah. Amazing.
I love little director signature things like that. In this case, Steckler, by necessity, had to use his car. It was the only car he had the key to.
Right.
But then he had his, like, the Trooper would be, like, a through-line thing that he used way more than he needed to. But then you have, like, John Landis, who came up earlier, not by name. He has the See You Next Wednesday thing, where there's a movie called See You Next Wednesday that's always playing in John Landis movies. And sometimes it's an action film, sometimes it's a porn film, and or whatever, you know, but it's, like, that's, like, always the thing. Like, or in the background of some scene, I'll just say, you know, those little posters saying, like, coming next week, see you next Wednesday. And Sam Raimi with the car and stuff like that. It's really fun.
Yeah.
You know, it makes anything that humanizes a filmmaker to me is valuable, because this thing of like deifying creative people is stupid. They're not more special. It's like, we can all do these things. We should all do these things in whatever way we want to, you know?
Yeah.
Getting our ideas out. And like, to show people that that's possible by just being a schlub, like a great schlub, you know, like that's valuable. You know, like that's what inspiration comes from. And so like, I think, I don't know, when I get all excited about filmmakers, that's what it is. It's like, this guy wasn't especially talented by standard measures at all. Right. I mean, the opposite, but he showed everybody that they have the right to try to do this thing, you know? And just by like the trying to do it is the success in doing it.
Right.
Like, it's not the reward. There's not the financial end. It's nothing else. Like, and so like, I know this sounds weird, but it's like all this silly stuff that we talked about with him and all his limitations are what made him great.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
I think that's a great spot to end and get into our double feature picks.
Oh, sure.
So Zach, you're our guest. So if you were programming a double feature, including Incredibly Strange Creatures, what would you pair it with?
Incredibly Strange Creatures is, it's a darker film for him, even though it's like, you could show it to a 3-year-old, but you know, it has a like venomous, wrathful character, you know, in Madame Estrella, you know,
yeah,
fortune teller, and it has a murderer who's a trooper, played by Ray Dennis Steckler, which is funny, playing very cool, playing like a very like beatnik, kind of like,
yeah,
you know, disaffected guy until he is possessed with the spirit of murder. So he starts trooping, and then he's kind of this helpless, lost soul, you know? So that's like a darker theme. So I would pair it with a movie that I like way too much, which is The Lemon Grove Kids, because that's Stekler trying to do like a more horror themed, like Little Rascals thing, right? It's really the Bowery Boys. It's like him doing like an outmoded type of Hollywood comedy with his friends, which is now like three generations more outmoded than it was when he made it.
Yeah.
So it's kind of alien. It's like an alien type of entertainment. Like it's not like a sort of comedy that anybody who's still breathing was exposed to before, but it's so innocent. And it feels very much like those movies are not only made for kids, but like were made specifically for his three daughters. Like it's like Stekler got all of his friends together and called in every favor he had just to entertain his kids, which is amazing. Like that's like who does that? Like
it's awesome.
I don't know, it's like the best dad ever. I'd say like Incredibly Strange Creatures being like his most well-known film because of the title, probably, you know. And then and like representative of him trying to with the biggest budget he's ever gonna have, you know, like showing what he can do with that and what he can't do with that. And then with like a movie that he made like with his neighbors at his house for his kids, you know, and like those two things together, they're both horror movies, ostensibly. Neither one is a traditional horror movie.
Right.
And they're both very representative of him, but like they're him at opposite ends of, you know, his career. I mean, you know, the spectrum of his like, you know, budget and everything, kind of doing what he does best, which is just like entertaining the people he loves and himself. And then if you can get on board with that, that's great. And if you don't, that's great too.
Yeah.
Like, yeah. I love that about him.
Lance, what about you?
So there is a scene in Incredibly Strange Creatures, like right before Jerry goes into, or I think it might be right before what's her name, Marge, Carolyn Brandt goes into Madame Estrelle's. There's in the background, you see the fun house painted, you know, it's just a common carnival attraction for traveling carnivals. So I'm going very literal with that. I'm going to go with Toby Hooper's The Fun House from 1981. It has the carnival, the traveling carnival, the kind of, you know, creepy carnies. It has that strange creature, Gunther.
Is Herb Robbins in it?
Herb Robbins is in it. Yeah. When you said his name, I was like, oh my God. Yeah. And he plays like the carnival manager.
Yeah.
So there's a tie-in with Stekler there too.
Yeah, that's weird. So, were you thinking about that?
I wasn't until you were trying to figure out his name. And then I saw him and I was, oh, okay, well, even better.
Yeah.
Even closer. Even a better reason to watch it with Incredibly Strange Creatures. But yeah, I think most people listening have probably heard it or heard about it. They know the plot and the summary. But yeah, I love that movie. Great practical effects. Way bigger budget, obviously, than Stekler. But you got Rick Baker.
But still weirdly confined. Like it was like a major release.
Yeah, I mean, I don't remember. Is it a single night? Like, because I know the kids, like the whole premise is they dare each other to like stay in a carnival in the fun house. Is it a single?
I believe so.
Location. Yeah. Like, yeah, it's fun. That's my pick.
So I was thinking along the same lines of like a carnival movie as well. You know, there's Malatesta's Carnival of Blood from 73.
That's a wild one.
Carnival of Blood, 1972, starring Burt Young. We were talking about earlier. Yeah.
Yeah.
But there were some actual films that were double features with Incredibly Strange Creatures. So in the spirit of recreating those, even though if they were paired for no reason at all, that, you know, that's fine. Beast of Yucca Flats was one of them.
Tor.
Yes, Tor. But the one that I picked is one that I just watched recently for June's Exploitation, and that's The Sadist from 1963, starring Arch Hall Jr.
Which is so close to Thrill Killers.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It actually would, but I feel like if you put The Sadist and The Thrill Killers together, it's too close.
Yeah.
So in this case, I'm like, you know what? This was a double feature back in whatever year that happened. I would want to just recreate that. And hopefully if I got to be in the theater for that, then, you know, I could have a zombie running up and down the aisles and maybe even Arch Hall Jr. being like, with his gun. Give me a Coke. And I can't do it.
It's good.
But yeah, folks haven't seen The Sadist. It's on Tubi right now. It's about three people who are driving to LA for a baseball game. They get sidetracked at a car trouble. They get at an old wrecking yard and they're held hostage by Arch Hall Jr. and his girlfriend. So
teenage maniacs.
Yeah.
Yes.
It's a fun one. So, okay. Next episode is our Horror Gives Back wrap up episode, watching movies for charity. We're just going to wrap up all the films that we watch for that. We'll share our total that we raised for Best Friends Animal Society. Lance, are you doing your next pick now, or do you want to wait till that episode?
We'll save it for the Horror Gives Back episode.
Okay, so folks, you have to listen to the 5-hour next episode.
You can skip ahead, but yeah, you should sit through it.
to find out what Lance's pick for No Rules November is going to be. Zach, thank you for coming back.
Oh, thank you guys.
And talking about Steckler.
Yeah, I mean, we talked about Steckler being inspirational, but like when I hear Zach talk, and like it's very inspiring. Like, I feel like I should go make a movie. You give me like hope that I can just do something creative that I might be holding back.
I think it's our human duty that a lot of people have just cast aside, but it's like, that's what we're here for.
Yeah. We love having you on.
Yeah. So does Piper. She's awake. She didn't get to put in her double feature pick, but
she's like, what are we talking about here? Let's go.
All right. Thanks everyone for listening. We'll see you back next episode for our Horror Gets Back recap. Night, y'all.
When night come home and he happens well, mama's waiting at the door to give me a well. You're gonna, you gotta say, you gotta say, you gonna.